It's good to see everybody today. And James, thanks for sharing your birthday with us. Special day. Five. I don't know if this is sort of my testimony or not, but it's an interesting thing that what I'm going to speak about today is a culmination of probably a year of challenge. And I felt in a pretty dry spot spiritually for quite a while. And I don't know, was it a month ago? I got a call from Springvale saying, "We would like you to speak for 3 days and do a spiritual revival for us." And I thought, man, am I the wrong guy to be talking about spiritual revival when I feel like I'm in a dry spot? And yet the more I thought about it, the more I talked about it with Sharon, the more we discussed it, the more I was like, who better than me to need spiritual revival? And as I've thought about it, and Sharon's been a great help in a lot of our discussions, what is the purpose of this time of year? We have the fall feast coming upon us. And why do we have these appointments with God? And one of the challenges that I've been looking and thinking about is why, not what days do we keep or what the name of them are, but why does God want appointments with us? And I think one of the, look at that liquid sunshine that brings life to the land out there. It's a revival, that rain, grace like rain coming down. And so what I'd like to do is hopefully meet in due season, because we do have the fall festival days upon us, but I'd like to start what you might think is in a rather unusual spot, to start talking about possibly one of the purposes of the fall feast. If you turn with me to Revelation chapter 3, chapters 2 and 3 are about the seven churches. And as you start digging into the topic that I'm going to get into, I think this has relevance for all of us, but also it's had specific relevance to me. And we read in verse 1, I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version, and it says, "And to the angel of the church in Sardis write, these are the words of him who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars." And if you go back to chapter 1, you realize it's talking about the Messiah. And the seven stars are the seven angels of the seven churches. You can read in Isaiah what I believe are the seven spirits before God. But he says this to a church in Sardis. Now, what I am not a believer that the church eras were of chronological, but I don't rule that out. I don't believe that they're sequential, but I don't rule that out. I believe in every case it says, let anyone who has an ear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. It applies universally. And what he says to the church in Sardis, which was a physical place, a real church, he said, "I know your works. You have a name of being alive, but you are dead. Wake up and strengthen what remains and is on the point of death. For I have not found your works perfect in the sight of my God." The problem in Sardis was not heresy, but spiritual death. They had the appearance, they had the reputation of doing things. Look at their reputation. And yet, Christ is saying, but spiritually, you're dead. You have a problem. You have a reputation, you do works, you do all these things, and people think, wow, look at that church, or even look at that individual. They must really be close to God. Look at what they're doing. Look at how they're recognized. Look at how they're presented. And yet he said, the fact of the matter is that they're dead. The Spirit had no words of commendation for them because spiritually they were dead. So I would ask you, if I were to take a poll about you individually and go to your friends, go to your neighbors, go to your coworkers, go to your family and say, how are they spiritually? And you take notes and record and say, oh, they all say, oh, and we all get a reputation of who we are by what we do. What would they say about your spiritual condition? So think about that. If I were to go to your spouse or your neighbor or your friends or your brothers and sisters or other people in church, what would they say about your spiritual condition? Because we all have a reputation, right? And many of us have a reputation to uphold. So think about that. Over here, I got all this list, this chalkboard, whatever, a whiteboard with what would people say about your spiritual condition? And if I were able at the next moment to go up before the throne and talk to the Father in heaven and say, will you tell me what you think their spiritual relationship is with you? What would he say about your relationship with him versus what do other people say? And it's based on this thing in Sardis that in the community, in their fellowship, and they had great reputation for being of God, and yet God says, you're dead. You're dead. I'd like Sharon to read from Philippians chapter 2:13, because that's going to be my transition to the point of my message today. It's about meat in due season. Because I struggled until she pointed this out. I've been trying to do a spiritual revival on my own. If I can just work up the effort, work up the zeal, work up the desire, work, if I can just apply myself, I will, you'll pull yourself up by the bootstraps theory. And I was struggling. So Sharon, will you read, I don't know what version you've got, but Philippians 2:13.
Hello. It's the, I can't remember, I just looked, New Living Translation. And Philippians 2:13 says, for God is working in you, giving you the desire and the power to do what pleases him.
And the key word there was, in that version, it says, he will give us the desire and the power to do what pleases him. Because I will tell you from my own experience, you can't do it on your own. So my prayers have changed. Please give me the will, the desire, the motivation, the courage, the persistence to pursue you. Because that's what it's all about, that we are to be in a very close relationship with God. Now what I'd like to do is go to the book of Nehemiah, because I feel that this, more than any book in the Bible, gives us a sense of the process of revival. Now, to give you a little background, let me get to Nehemiah. Yes. We're going to start in Nehemiah. Just at the beginning. I didn't say a chapter. Not yet. The history of the context of Nehemiah is 300 years before Nehemiah, the northern kingdom of Israel was conquered and most of the people were carried away captive. That was about 722 BC. So think of 300 years ago. That was before the founding of our country. Israel, northern Israel, was taken away. That's 722. Sargon of Assyria, he was the king, the pharaoh, the ruler, whatever, that came in, took away captives and they're dispersed. That's why they're called the lost tribes of Israel. They just got dispersed around the world, but they were taken away and gone. That was 300 plus years before Nehemiah. And only a few people from Israel were actually left, just sprinkling of people. And then Sargon brought in all these captives from other lands because he was a conquering kingdom. And he put them in that land because God had promised he was going to take away Israel because of their sins and all that. And so those captives came in from other lands and they started intermarrying with a few of the Israelites who had been left behind, a tithe of them maybe. And they became known as the Samaritans. They were never from Israel, but they intermarried with just a few from Israel. So the context is for 300 plus years, these Samaritans had grown and taken over and now ruled the land of northern Israel. But then we go back to 586 BC, where Jerusalem is destroyed, and the Jews were taken from Jerusalem, because see, Judah had still stayed there for almost a couple hundred years, 722 to 586, 1400, 140, 150 years later, Judah is taken captive, and they're all taken to Babylon. And the promise was that they would be in captivity for 70 years, and you remember Daniel and all this. And then we have the story that the first exiles returned to Jerusalem in 537 with Zerubbabel. And their commission was to rebuild the temple. That was the goal. They were coming back to Jerusalem that had been abandoned for 70 years. And guess who filled the vacuum? The Samaritans, the Arabs, the whole bunch of ites around there said, they're gone. They're taken captive. It's our land, our city. So Zerubbabel came back in 537 to rebuild the temple. And then 21 years later, Zerubbabel and his group completed the temple. Along the way, in 458, that's 80 years later from Zerubbabel, Ezra came. You're familiar with these names, Zerubbabel rebuilding the temple. And then Ezra came in 458. And what they encountered was a city that was controlled and run by the Samaritans and the Arabs and the Heshbonites and all these other people. And there was a small Jewish population that had a temple, but the temple was barely built. And then finally, 13 years after Ezra, a guy named Nehemiah comes on the scene. And that's the context that we have when we start the book of Nehemiah. That the land for 300 years has been controlled by the Samaritans. The temple has been built 60 years previously. It took them 21 years to build the temple. But that's all that had happened. Some Jews had come back. They stayed there. They had a partially functioning temple. But the city was still in ruins. The city was a mess. And we start the book of Nehemiah. The challenge is today that I would like us to have a take-home point, that there are principles of revival in the book of Nehemiah that we can use for the fall holy days for both individual and community revival. It's amazing when I look at the parallels of what is in the book of Nehemiah and how it can totally relate to us. And today I want to make it fairly simple in that I'm going to give you an A, a B, and a C point. And if you can remember the A, the B, and the C, hopefully that will help you as we get into the Fall Holy Days to, one, go read the book of Nehemiah, and with these principles of A, B, and C, that you can see, does that relate to you? And can you apply those principles? Can you start the process with asking God for the desire and the will to please Him? I think that's the most critical point, that we must ask Him for the will to please Him. Because if you're in a spiritually dry spot, and you know it, on our own, we're not capable of changing it. But the first thing I think we can learn from Nehemiah is that you must have awareness. Awareness. That's my A. Because when you read chapter 1, verse 1, it says, these are the words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, and you're going to forgive me if I mess up a lot of the names. There are lots of ayahs and whatever. I get Benaiah right, but there's a lot of them. Now, this is also one of the rare books in Scripture that is written in the first person. Nehemiah is saying, I did this, and I thought that, and I felt this, and he's writing it in the first person, and there's very few books in Scripture that are written in the first person. So it says, the words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that's the capital of, I think it was Artaxerxes. Let me get the right king here. It's in my book here. Artaxerxes. So he's in Susa, the capital. And it says, one of my brothers, Hanani, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them about the Jews that survived, those who had escaped the captivity, and about Jerusalem. So remember, Ezra and Zerubbabel had gone 13 years before or 80 years before. He was a Jew. He knew the history. And so he says, how's it going in Jerusalem? What do you hear? What's news from Jerusalem? And they replied, the survivors there in the province who escaped captivity are in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been destroyed by fire. It was like, huh? I thought things were going great. Because we read in verse 4, he said, when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, fasting and praying before the God of heaven. He was astonished in that I had no idea things were like that. And sometimes I think in our own lives we can intellectually know things, but until somebody points something out, we can say, I had no idea that's the way things were for ourselves or for our community. And so I want you to look at what Nehemiah's response was when he heard something that he was now made aware of. So he wept and mourned for days, fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And then look what he did. I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love Him and keep His commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. So he's praying. He's been going fasting and praying for days, but now here's his prayer. He says, I now pray before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both I and my family have sinned. We have offended you deeply, failing to keep the commandments, the statutes, and the ordinances that you commanded to your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses. He said, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are under the farthest skies, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place at which I have chosen to establish my name. They are your servants and your people whom you redeemed by your great power and your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. And so what he did when he became aware, he started praying. He did what I'll call the universal Christian responsibilities. He turned to God and he prayed and he fasted and he thought on it. And he confessed sins not only for himself, but for his family, but for the nation. And I ask you, have you ever confessed to God for forgiveness for the sins of the nation or for your family? Think of Job. He was considered a righteous man. He was always doing things on behalf of his family. And so here Nehemiah is saying, I had no idea it was so bad. But he started off praying and fasting and confessing not only his sins, but his family's sins, but the sins of the people and calling on the mercy of God. So I think there's a really important part there, and it's called confession. Because when you turn back to Psalm 139, not only was Nehemiah praying, he was confessing his sins, his family's sins, his nation's sins. And I remind you of Psalm 139, David's prayer. And at the beginning you can see where God knows every intimate part about David. But in verse 23, here's what he says. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my thoughts. See if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. David is praying, God, I'm confessing who I am, but I need you to look into me. I need you to show me what's wrong with me. It goes back to, will we ask God for the will to change, the will to turn, the will to pursue him? And that's what David was doing. Search me and know my heart. Test me and know my thoughts and see if there's any evil, if there's any sin, if there's any wicked way in me. And help me to change and lead me in the way everlasting. So let's go back to Nehemiah chapter 1. I stopped in verse 11 where it says, O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. I think that's a key point. Give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. For at the time, I was cupbearer to the king. I had access to the Most High on the land. He was king of a whole lot of territory, and guess who saw him morning, noon, and night? I had his ear. And it's interesting that after he does this praying and fasting and confessing and all this, he says, now give success to me, because he came up with a plan to change things. He had a plan that resulted. And I think that's critical, that he had a plan to help restore what had been torn down. Now, I'm applying this to my life. I've been really evaluating where I'm at and what I'm doing. And I'll just share with you, part of my plan is I have to commit not only my heart to God, but I'm asking him to give me the desire. But there's some things I've got to do. I've got to start exercising more. Stress, I'm in a very stressful position right now, and I haven't been exercising, and I haven't been eating as well as I should, and that just saps my strength, takes my energy, helps me be discouraged, all these things, and I have good intentions, but I don't do it. So I've got to have a plan to exercise on a regular basis, because it's proven time and time and time again, when we exercise and our heart pumps better and our mind is clear, we have more energy, we can deal with things better. There is so much about just exercise. Combine that with the crap that this world puts out in the food market. Sharon has been very persistent in saying, Jeff, you need to eat better. And I say, yeah. Pretty soon it's in one ear and out the other. And you know what? I have to eat better. If I cannot take care of the body, the temple that God's given me, how can I spiritually reconnect with Him if I'm spending all of my time being discouraged, depressed, tired, fatigued, sick? I have a responsibility too. And then part of my plan is to focus on my universal Christian responsibilities. Every single person who is a believer, and unless you can show me otherwise, has a universal Christian responsibility to read the Word of God, to pray to the Most High God, to meditate on the Word of God, and unfortunately, on a somewhat regular basis, needs to fast to draw closer to God. And I can always say, yeah, but I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it tomorrow. We have to have a plan, brethren. And Nehemiah had a plan. And I'm going to skip through a lot of this because what Nehemiah did, he said, I have a plan, and O king, because the king said, what's wrong, Nehemiah? You're usually a really positive guy. And he's moping around with just this look on his face. And the king knows, and he says, what's the problem? And he didn't say like most of us would say, I'm fine, really, I'm fine. It's no big deal. It's okay. I'll deal with it. He told them what was on his heart, and he said, well, whew, that's not good. Jerusalem's in that bad a shape. Even though it's my land, it's like, so what? It's going on out in Montana. Sorry about that. That's just a long ways away, and too bad for them, and nobody's brought it up, and Sanballat and Tobias, the people who are out there ruling it, they're not saying there's any problems, but Nehemiah is saying, but for the Jews, it's really bad. So he said, what can I do for you? And he said, I have a plan, O king. And he told the king the plan, and the king said, well, how long is this going to take? And he said, I have a return date, so I'm coming back, but I just need a... And he never says how long the time was, but he said they agreed to a time. He said, oh, by the way, can you give me letters of reference so I can get wood from your forest and safe passage, and that I'll be recognized as your representative? He had a plan of what it was, because what his goal was to go back and rebuild what had been torn down, what had been made desolate, and had been left that way for 300 years. Or, if you go back to when Jerusalem was destroyed, 140 years. A long time that the rubble of Jerusalem had been around. And so what he does, he goes back, and we can see that he goes through there, and in chapter 2, he finally gets to Jerusalem, all his plan, because it started in the month of Chislev, and as we go through, it'll be interesting when you see how the months of the year line up on the Jewish calendar and where they end up before there's a revival. But he gets to Jerusalem, we read in chapter 2, verse 11. So he says, I get to Jerusalem, and I was there for 3 days. But he didn't tell anybody why he was there. He just showed up, and he spent 3 days there sort of checking out the situation. And then he said he went out at night to investigate the condition of the walls of Jerusalem. Now, we have to put ourselves in the context of people in the Middle East at that time. A walled city was a very, very important thing. A walled city was for protection. It was a boundary around them that kept people out. It did not give them easy access. But all the gates in Jerusalem were destroyed. All the walls were just rubble on the ground. They were fair pickings for any group that came in, because they had no walls. Think of what it was like when Jericho, you know, you go back to the walled city and they're saying, how are we going to take this city? Look at the walls on that thing. It's really hard to attack because we're exposed and they can pick us off. And it's like, oh God, and God said, I got you covered there. But here Jerusalem, for all these decades, if not centuries, the rubble is all over the ground. And the people were exposed, and the people were discouraged, and the people were in subjection to the rulers, the lords of the land. And it was a bad deal if you were a Jew in Jerusalem. You might have had a temple, But you were totally subject to the whims of all the rulers of that area who were Samaritans. Now, I ask you to remember that word, Samaritan. 400 plus years later, in the time of Christ and Paul and all that, the Jews and the Samaritans still were hating each other. They had nothing to do with each other. They didn't want to interact in any way. Well, guess what? It was 400 years earlier, and they were still the same way. Families fighting, neighbors fighting. So Nehemiah goes, and he, if you read the account in chapter 2, he at night takes his horse or his donkey, and he's out checking out the gates and checking out the walls. And there's so much rubble in places that his animal can't even walk through there, so he has to get off on foot, and at night he's climbing over the stones and the rubble and checking out the condition of the wall of Jerusalem, that if it was built, would give them boundary, it would give them safety, it would give them protection. And so I ask you to look at this whole issue. Are there areas in your life that have been demolished and destroyed and are in rubble, and you need to erect boundaries for protection and for safety? So he does this stuff at night, and he comes back in and he's saying, man, do we have a job to do? There is nothing here that's worth saving. We're going to have to start basically from scratch. And in verse 17, he calls the people to be together. Now remember, he had the authority of the king, so this wasn't like he just showed up and they said, who are you? So I'll ask you, do we not have the authority of the king? He lives in us. We're in him, he's in us. We have the authority of the king. Then he said to them, speaking to the people, you see the trouble we are in. This is verse 17 of chapter 2. How Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we may no longer suffer disgrace. I told them that the hand of my God had been gracious upon me, and also the words that the king had spoken to me. Then they said, let's start building. So they committed themselves to the common good. So you know what he did? He came in, and this is part B. He said, we need to build the wall. So there's an awareness, then you need to build the wall. But he had a vision. And he told the people the vision, whether it's a vision for you, or the vision for your family, or the vision for the community. He had a vision, and the people bought into it because God was involved in it. And so they all say, let's start building. So they committed themselves to the common good. So here's to me a fascinating point, that as soon as you pray to God for the will to pursue him, the will to follow him, the will to please him, and you start coming up with a plan based on your universal Christian responsibility, so you have awareness, you have God backing you, you have a plan, you sell it, you have a vision, and it's like, this is so good. We read in verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they mocked and ridiculed us, saying, what is this that you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Then I replied to them, the God of heaven is the one who will give us success, and we, his servants, are going to start building. You have no share or claim or historic right in Jerusalem. Instantly, when they came together to rebuild, to take up that which had been destroyed, they ran into opposition. So I will tell you, as soon as you commit to God and you have a plan and you have a vision, you are going to run into opposition. This is the story of Nehemiah. But it's also the story of watch what happens when you are committed to a vision, committed to a plan. And it said in chapter 3, it starts going through the dozen or more gates that are in the city of Jerusalem and how everybody had a job to do. They all said, we're in, and the walls are in ruin, the gates are all burned. There's like, oh, we've got a job to do. And as you read chapter 3, it talks about how each group, each family, each set of people, the priests or the Levites or heads of households and their families. You can even read, forget where it was, this one man and his daughters were out there working. This was total involvement by every. This wasn't a guy thing. It was all hands on deck. We have to rebuild the walls and the gates of Jerusalem for safety, for protection, for boundaries. And that's what we need to do. And so as you go through all of chapter 3, it's talking about all the people that were involved in taking a portion of the wall. And as you read through it, you will find that most of them built the portion of a wall near where they lived. They had a vested interest. They took ownership. They didn't say, well, we're going to go build on the other side of the city. They let the people who were over there build. And they said, we want protection in our part, by my house, by this gate, so that they were doing it for the common good, but they were invested because it was going to help them as well. This goes back to the sense of revival as a community or a national revival, let alone an individual. There's something in it for you, but it's also to help all those who are in Jerusalem. And so we go through and they're energized. There's ridicule and mocking and there's threatening by all the rulers of the area. But they all say, Nehemiah, we get it. It's past due. It's been hundreds of years. We need to rebuild the wall for our own safety and protection. And so we get to chapter 4. And it says, now when Sanballat heard that we were building a wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he mocked the Jews. He said in the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria, that's the land that they were in, the Samaritans, remember? He had an army, and they had no walls, and they were a small part of the population. And so he's mocking them and ridiculing them in front of his army and putting them down. And they're looking out and saying, this guy is really angry, and he's really enraged, and he's got an army that he's in control of. What are we going to do? And it goes back to when you have a plan and you start to engage a plan, we have an enemy. He's going to come after you, and he's got an army who are out there looking and saying, we're going to sabotage this. And he said, what will these feeble Jews, or what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore things? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish it in a day? You think in one day you're going to turn this around? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and the burned ones at that? Think about the desolation from a destroyed city or a house. You ever gone to a burned house? You might have foundation walls, but when you look at the chars and the rubble, some of the stones were still black with soot after all this time. He said, you got all these burned stones. What are you going to do? What do you think you're doing? As he sits there in front of his army saying, it's a ridiculous effort. Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that? Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him and he said, that stone wall they're building, any fox going up on it would break it down. They're ridiculing him. It's so pathetic what you're doing. Are you serious? You really think this is going to stand up? A fox? You ever seen a fox in real life? They're very small, they're very light, they're very agile. And they're saying, this wall won't even stand up to a fox. You guys are pathetic. Hear, O God, Nehemiah says, for we are despised. Turn their taunt back on their own head and give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover their guilt and do not let their sins be blotted out from your sight. For they have hurled insults in the face of the builders. He didn't go tit for tat. He didn't say, oh yeah, you want to fight? He turned it over to God and he said, God, I'm putting them in your hands, and by the way, I want you to smite them and turn them into captivity and do all these things to them because they are opposing you. He turned to God. So that's a key lesson from Nehemiah. In the face of opposition, he didn't take it on himself. He turned to God and said, I'm putting that in your hands. And in verse 6, it says, so we rebuilt the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. So things are going, in the spite of all this taunting, in spite of all this ridicule, in spite of all that, they got the wall up to half its height. Now, think about building a big fence around your yard, and you need a 6-foot fence or an 8-foot fence, and you only get it halfway up. It's been a ton of work. It's not really going to keep out what you need if it's only half built. The gates are not enclosed, the wall's not to its full height. Remember, this is a wall for protection and safety. There have to be people walking around the tops. They're going to have at the gates guard towers. This is a work incomplete. It's halfway there. And so we read in verse 7 that the wall was up halfway. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and the gaps were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. The enemy did not like progress. The enemy was against protection and safety. And it says, and all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. So they hear, all right, not only the Samaritan army, but you have now the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, the Haranites. All of a sudden, everybody's getting together to oppose us, and it's like, the harder we work, the worse things look. Now we have an even bigger group opposing us. And guess what? That's what the enemy's going to do to us. When we start turning to God, when we start asking Him to help us build the boundaries, to restore what was torn down, things that are broken in our lives, we're going to get opposition and opposition and opposition. But their response was always to turn to God and say, I can only do it with your help. So in verse 9 we read, so we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. They were, I guess in our term, DEFCON 4. We have a big problem. We're going to pray, but we're going to set guards so that they don't come upon us unawares. We don't want to be surprised. We don't want to be a sneak attack and overrun and do everything that we've done. So we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. But Judah said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, and there is too much rubbish that we aren't able to work the wall. They got to a point where they still had all this stuff from all these decades and centuries in the way, and they're saying, we can't even clear out the rubble to finish working on the wall. There's too much. We're tired. We're worn out. And we're unable to keep working on the wall. And in verse 11 we read, and our enemies said, they will not know or see anything before we come upon them and kill them and stop the work. So when the Jews who lived near them came, they said to us 10 times. So this was widely known. People, the Jews out in the cities and in the communities said, 10 times we've come to you and said, they're going to attack the wall. They're going to overrun you. They're getting their forces. They're going to come against you. So in verse 12, we read that, when the Jews who lived near them came, they said to us 10 times, from all the places where they live, they will come up against us. So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open places, Nehemiah said, I stationed the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. Call to arms, folk. The enemy is coming after us. Call to arms. They know they're going to be overrun. They know they're going to be attacked. And Nehemiah says in verse 14, and after I looked these things over, I stood up and said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Eternal, who is great and awesome. and fight for your kin, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. The goal is to repair the wall, to build the boundaries, to have safety and protection. It's interesting, though, when verse 15 it says, when our enemies heard that their plot was known to us and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. The people were not going to be caught unawares. They were not going to be home sleeping in their beds. They were not going to be discouraged and say, we gave up, so that they could come over the half wall. But here's what's interesting to me. It says, from that day on, half of my servants worked on construction and half held the spears, shields, bows, and body armor, and the leaders posted themselves behind the whole house of Judah. The leaders were there, and everybody was in full armor. So I'm going to ask you, do we show up every day in full armor? The enemy is against us. The enemy wants to, it says he's seeking whom he may devour. We have to be on guard against the wiles and the deceit, the trickery of the enemy. Do we have the full armor? Because what happened is when things got dangerous, the community gathered together. It was all the people. All the people, when you read those verses in 13 to 20, all the people were involved. The community came together because it was a dangerous time. They worked together, they drew together. And so we read here, from that day on, half my servants worked on construction, half held the spears, shields, bows, and body armor, and the leaders posted themselves behind the whole house of Judah. Everybody was involved who were building the wall. The burden bearers carried their loads in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and with the other held a weapon. Can you imagine trying to be a stonemason or a brick mason or a block mason and you have a sword in one hand? Now I'm right-handed, so I would hold my sword in my right and I'd be gathering a block, and Dennis will have a sword in his hand and he's going to smear the mortar, and somebody else is going to haul, and we're on guard. We're ready to go to battle because the enemy could come. But it says that they worked with one hand and they held their sword in the other. And they had half the people with spears and bows and shields, and half were working. And each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me. There was great vigilance, is what he's saying. And I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and widely spread out, and we are separated far from one another. Because remember, they're all working on their part of the wall, all around the whole city of Jerusalem. Rally to us whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet. Our God will fight for us. So if there was trouble, they said, you got to come running. We need help. We got all these armies. So we labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. That's a long day. From the break of dawn until the stars come out, they labored. Half were working at a shift, and then the other half. I said also to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night inside Jerusalem, so that they may be a guard for us by night and may labor by day. Talk about a 24-hour commitment. So neither I nor my brothers nor my servants nor the men of the guard who followed me ever took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon in his right hand. They were clothed in their armor 24 hours a day. They didn't take it off. Now, I can't imagine the hygiene, but they were committed to a task. They were committed to our task. Now, we're going to skip over chapter 5 because Nehemiah then said, the people are not being treated right. The rulers in Jerusalem, the lords, those in charge, they were charging interest. They had taken interest. They had notes on property. People needed to be fed, so they had to give up their land, their vineyards. And Nehemiah said, this is not right. We're all in the boat together. and you can read about it. And he was convincing enough, and their heart were turned enough that they gave back the land, they gave back the vineyards, they gave back all the stuff that they had taken from oppressing their own people. And so things started to get restored while the work of the wall was undergoing, so that people would be fed, they would have a vocation, they'd have land, they'd have food. And he said in verse 14, just so you're aware, that even though as a governor of the land he was entitled for the people to give him the governor's share for food and wine and animals and all this stuff, he said, I never took it in the 12 years that I was there. I provided for 150 people a day. Think about this. It said, for one day, in verse 18, there was one ox, six choice sheep, fowls, and every day 10 skins of wine in abundance. And yet with all this, I did not demand the food allowance of the governor because of the heavy burden of labor on the people. That's amazing. Every day an ox, six sheep, fowls, 10 skins of wine, just to feed the people in his house. So we go into verse chapter 6, because in chapter 5, Nehemiah is restoring property and rights and blessings to the people because it was wrong. They weren't obeying God. And they had stayed dressed, all while the rebuilding of the wall. In chapter 6, we read, now it was reported to Sanballat and Tobiah and to Geshem the Arab and to the rest of our enemies that I had built the wall and that there was no gap left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors and the gates. So the wall is built, but there's no gates. They have all these dozen or more gates in Jerusalem, and there's no doors on them. So, like, that's not good. There's no protection there. They can pour in through the gates. So Sanballat and Geshem and Tobiah said, come out, let's meet together in one of the villages in the plain of Ono. We need to have a parley. We see what you're doing. Let's talk about this, okay? Come out and let us meet. But he said, I know they intended to do me harm. There's no good in this meeting. There's something behind it. He was very discerning. So I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Now I ask you, when you talk about revival of yourself, of your family, of our community, of our nation, is that our attitude when we have distractions and invitations from the enemy? Do you say, no, I'm not going there. I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. I have to accomplish what's been set before me. And that was his attitude. This is too important to go meet with the enemy. There's no parley. There's no negotiation. There's no getting together. They sent to me four times in this way, and I answered them in the same manner. In the same way, Sanballat for the fifth time sent a servant to me with an open letter in his hand. And so four times they asked, four times he said, this is too important. I am committed to this. So they tried a different tactic. He sent a letter and he said, oh, by the way, we're going to report to the king that you're setting yourself up as king and you're going to cause a rebellion and we're going to report you and we're going to spread this rumor and all this stuff and the king's going to come against you. And they started spreading lies and deceit and were trying to intimidate him into compromising. What did he say? Then I sent back to him saying, no such things as you say have been done. You are inventing them out of your own mind, for all they wanted was to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. And then he went, here's another thing. When you're trying to accomplish a relationship through a plan based on the inspiration of God, the enemy's got all these different ways he's going to try and get to you. In verse 10 we read, he went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Delaiah, son of Mehetabel, who was confined to his house. an advisor. And the man said, let's go to the house of God within the temple and let's close the doors of the temple, for they're coming to kill you. Indeed, tonight they're going to come and kill you. So let's go to the Lord's house. Let's go there for protection and safety. Sounds plausible, doesn't it? Let's go to the temple. We'll be safe there because they're coming to kill you. And they're coming tonight. We need to get over there. He said, should a man like me run away? Would a man like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. And it said, then I perceived and saw that God had not sent him at all, but he had pronounced a prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Within his own midst, he had somebody who was working for the enemy, trying to trick him and betray him. And we just have to be aware, but it always goes back to, if you are committed to what you're doing and you know God is involved in it, he will take care of it. Because when he said, no, I'm not going to do that, God revealed to him the trick that it was. But it wasn't until he said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to save myself. I have a job to fulfill. I have a commitment to adhere to. It says in verse 13, he was hired for this purpose, to intimidate me and make me sin by acting in this way, so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, according to the things that they did, and also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. Their own people were conspiring against him. And finally it happens, so the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month of Elul in 52 days. 52 days of working on the wall they accomplished as a group, 52 days of staying dressed in their clothes, 52 days of fighting off the enemy, 52 days of setting things right, 52 days it took them to complete the wall and the gates. And it said, and when all our enemies heard of it, the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem, for they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Moreover, in those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came to them. For many in Judah were bound to him by an oath, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, son of Era, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam. And they spoke of his good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. So here all the advisors are telling the enemies everything that Nehemiah was saying, because they were related to him by blood or by oath or by responsibility. Let me go to C. We did awareness. We talked about building the wall. C is commitment. All through this, Nehemiah had commitment to the task, to the plan at hand. The issue was that he had to take small steps in implementing the plan. They couldn't build the walls in one day. He had to get the people behind the vision. They made assignments and got them building. He had to stop and deal with their practices. He had to defend the poor, get them their land back, get them their food back, get them their... But everything that he dealt with, it was just one step at a time. We are not going to have full revival in one day. It's going to take time. It takes commitment. He had to deal with a lot of opposition. He had ridicule. We read about the deceit. We read about the trickery, the threatening behavior, the blackmailing behavior, people who refused to help. If you read the story, there's those that said, "Nah, I'm not going to help. I'm not involved in this at all. That's your problem, not my problem." And throughout that, Nehemiah had it because he kept a vision. His vision was that I am engaged in a great work and I will not stop. I'm going to stop here because when you read about what he did in the praise and celebration in inaugurating the wall, it's very inspiring. They had the troops go up to the right and to the left, and there was choirs and there were trumpets and there were rulers, and they had a great celebration for the wall. And once the wall was completed, we read in chapter 8, when the seventh month came, the people of Israel being settled in their towns, all the people gathered together in the square before the water gate, and they did it on the first day of the seventh month. The first day of the seventh month is trumpets coming up on Monday the 10th. All the wall had been rebuilt. They had praised God for the building of the wall, because Elul is a month before the seventh month. That's a sixth month. So on the first day of the seventh month, with the protection there, the wall there, the boundaries there, the safety there, they all gathered on the first day of the seventh month. And I'm going to drop it there because we're going to read on trumpets more of this. But it led to individual and community and national revival because of what they experienced together, the lessons that they had learned, and the celebration of the feast days that had not occurred since the time of Joshua. And so I would propose to you that we can use the lessons in Nehemiah, the lessons we will read about in chapter 8 and chapter 9, to use this fall festival season as a time of revival for us individually and as a community and hopefully as a body throughout, that God intends these days to be the basis for a spiritual revival, because I perceive that when he says, let he who has an ear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches, we can no longer, if we have, or we cannot afford to be known by our reputation to other people, but by God, he said, you are spiritually dead. And so I'll ask you, before trumpets comes about, to read the book of Nehemiah, read the lessons about awareness, about prayer, about confessions, about having a plan, about building the wall, taking it beyond just halfway up, knowing that it's dangerous and we need boundaries. We need a sense of community. We need to stay dressed in our armor every single day until the job is accomplished. And that takes commitment. And it takes small steps. It takes sacrifice. It's dealing with problems and ridicule and opposition and enemies. It's all the things that they experienced because they had vision. They had the vision of what God wanted them to do, and it led to revival. And we're going to start talking about that, what happened starting on the Feast of Trumpets in the time of Nehemiah, and what it led to for the individuals, the community, and the nation. And I'll stop there. Thoughts, comments?
Yeah, this, every time I read this book, why it gets more and more interesting. And a couple things that jumped out at me today was, this time of year, I tend to hear this more often, but we start coming up with excuses why, or allowing excuses to come in, why we can't do something that God, in a sense, has truly commanded, keeping the feast. And I hear excuses, well, school won't allow us. You know, we can't take that much time off. My boss won't allow me to take that much time off. I have this other commitment, so we're going to be there, but we're going to shrink down our time just a little bit. And notice the whole story starts off with Nehemiah asking his boss for time off. And look how God blesses that. And then at the end of the story, in chapter 6, why, I used to wonder, it's like, why does God's people need a wall around them? In chapter 6, we see the answer to that. They don't need a wall around them. God's been blessing and protecting them all along. But why did the wall need to get built? Jeff just read it here a couple minutes ago. Did anybody else see what happened? No, it's so that our enemies see that God is blessing and protecting us. We don't need the wall. We need to expose to everybody outside the wall that God is our God.
We'll see later on if you come on trumpets that there's also a purpose for the wall and the gates. It's what you keep out. And God is our tent. He is our covering. He is our shield. He is our, think of the corral, the gatefold, where Christ puts the sheep inside. Only the shepherd can come in, but it's to keep all the bad things out. I'll make that analogy of the Ten Commandments, too. It's a fence for us. If you stay within the boundaries, you're safe. When you crawl over the fence, you're out in a big, bad world, and you can get in trouble. And fences are also to keep you safe if you stay within them, but it's to keep bad things out. We'll read more on that. Dennis.
Just one thing that really, in the long run, is not important, except for an individual, from an individual standpoint. When you said he was a cupbearer, I know that you know what that means. He was that close because he's the guy that drinks the stuff before the king gets it, if there's poison or something there. But he was very close. So he was trustworthy enough as a person and lived his life right that he was in a position to do this. So individually, how close are we, how much are we looked up to in terms of our character and personality that people would say, yeah, I'll listen to Jeff. I mean, other than, if not, he didn't have the connection. So God used his character and righteousness. And the king obviously liked him. So there was God working with him. But it's built also on our individual growth as a person and how we're perceived in the area we're working at. That was just
funny.
It's just a tiny thing, but in my King James Bible it says they did take clothes off to worship.
Okay. I don't know where it says that, but the verse I read says we didn't take our clothes off, so...